Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a medic in the Pacific during World War II, this Reedley man shares how fortunate he feels to have survived.
I had my own private miracle.
And he had the trip of a lifetime with his nephew, also a Purple Heart recipient, as a medic in Vietnam. Don't miss their story on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done and endured incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we get to hear those stories each week as we honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We hope to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot about what life was like. Maybe we have some things we can apply to our own lives and draw some inspiration from. And we're going to have that conversation today with 89-year-old Dave Wall of Reedley, California, but originally from Madera, California. What was life like growing up in Madera before World War II?
Well, I grew up living on a farm. My dad was a rural mail carrier and a preacher and a farmer.
Pretty versatile guy.
Oh, yes, he did the whole works. So I grew up in a rural setting on a small farm. We had alfalfa and cotton and a few cows, some hogs and whatever else, chickens, whatever you have on a small farm. It was a carefree, interesting life. Good life.
You had two brothers and three sisters. Did you enjoy having a big family?
Well, actually, I was kind of a Johnny-come-lately. My oldest brother was 15 years older than I, so I didn't really have anything in common with him. And my other brother was just a year and a half older than I, and of course, we played together. We did everything together as kids. There was this gap in the family, so between the oldest and the youngest, and by the time I can remember, the oldest was out doing their own thing.
And you were in high school when World War II began. You were in high school still when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 41, and I imagine you remember that. Do you remember how you found out that day, what had happened way out there?
I very well remember that particular Sunday. We were in church as usual.
Your dad was preaching?
No, he was, well, he probably was too. This was in a service where we met with other churches, and there were about three churches gathering together. I was a teenager, and at the time, after lunch, a group of us, 15, 16-year-old, were sitting in one of the cars when the news came to us that Japan had attacked the United States. I was 16 at that time. Very well remember it.
Did you grasp what had happened there? I mean, did it hit you like a ton of bricks? What did that mean to you and those other teenage boys?
Well, at that time, as I recall, I thought to myself, what can little Japan possibly thinking about attacking the United States, great big country that we are? Our Army and Marines will take care of them in the next 35 days and we'll be back to normal. I didn't realize how wrong I could be. And at that point, at age 16, it never dawned on me that I would be a part of this conflict. I didn't believe that I would be, but I certainly was.
Well, yeah, so you would have graduated high school a few months later, on into 1942. When did you decide to get into the service, or was that decision made for you?
That decision was pretty well made by the draft board. I did what most of us guys did, try to dodge the draft as far as I could, but it didn't work, so I ended up in the Army. In the medical department attached to the Army.
What were your expectations, you think, about what Army life was going to be like?
It was a total surprise to me. Everything about it was totally different than my childhood. I don't think I'd ever been away from my family overnight, as I can recall. And then in an environment where we had scripture and prayer daily. And we moved into this environment where a group of mostly young people my age, full of energy and ambition and nonsense, and it was just totally different, completely different. I never imagined it would be like that.
Were you able to acclimate quickly?
Apparently so, because I stayed with it for the next nearly 2.5 years or whatever it was, yes.
What do you think was the most challenging aspect of your training?
Old farm boy, there was nothing about it difficult. Life-changing, if I were to mention one thing, during basic training at Camp Barkley, Texas, we had a visiting orthopedic specialist on one occasion, spoke to us. He had the battalion strong in there. He described our skeletons, naturally a bone doctor. He started at the tip of our head and went down to our toes, and when he got down to the sternum, he told us that if you find somebody where the sternum has been penetrated like with a bullet, don't worry about that guy because he's dead. And if he isn't, he will be in a few minutes because he's bleeding to death internally. So that message, I think, stuck with me as much as anything that I heard during the basic training session. That was the one thing that stayed with me. Oh, and he started this lecture, which was unusual in the Army. He started by quoting a scripture verse that we find in the book of Psalms, where the psalmist said, "I will praise the Lord, for I am wonderfully and fearfully made. Marvelous are thy works, O Lord, and of that my soul is well aware." So when he quoted scripture, I grabbed onto that, and I listened to him very intently. That's why I heard that speech about a bullet through the sternum.
So that got your attention, and then you were paying attention to hear something that was going to come in handy later?
That is exactly right. That caught my attention and alerted me to what was going on.
When did you head overseas, and were you a little apprehensive about what you might encounter?
Naturally, I was apprehensive and concerned. We left the port of Los Angeles on a troop ship. So I was going to say the Army treated us to an ocean cruise, but it wasn't exactly an ocean cruise. Our cruise liner was a troop ship, and we proceeded out of Los Angeles, and at that time we didn't know where we were going. And this ship that we were on was slow, 10 knots, they said, perhaps, and then it zigzagged all the way across the ocean. So we were 31 days between the port of Los Angeles and New Guinea. One interesting thing, while we were ocean-bound, and we had been on this ship and seen nothing but water for about 2 or 3 weeks, and the captain piped down and said, "Attention all troops, attention all troops. At 1,400 hours today, we will be within 1.5 miles of land." But he says, "Don't hurry to the side to see it, because you won't be able to. It's straight down." So that was one interesting thing that I always remember about that trip across the ocean. Also, a boiler blew out or something on the ship, and for about 2 days, we made just enough progress to tell we were moving. So we would have been a dead duck if the enemy had seen us.
Good thing they didn't. And did you get used to that pretty quickly? Were you starting to make some friends among the guys on that cruise liner with you?
Well, not necessarily, not really. I was assigned, along with some other guys that I never saw before, to a sergeant. And then he gave us instructions about who would have a job sweeping down the stairs and who would be doing something else and who would be doing KP. And some way or other, he missed me. So one day he caught me and he said, "What group are you with?" I said, "None." And he said, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing, goofing off." He said, "Well, you'll be doing something from now on for the rest of the trip. You'll be on KP down in the kitchen, scrubbing those big old 30-gallon boilers." So that was my position for the rest of that trip across the ocean. There was one benefit to that, which showed up later on. Out around the equator, a troop ship is very warm down in their quarters. Everything about it is hot, and the kitchen is even hotter, and the dining hall is hotter. So somebody got to the chaplain, and he made arrangements for us guys to stay on top board. We didn't have to go down. Everybody else had to go below deck. Total blackout, few minutes out of the port of Los Angeles. So I got to spend my nights on top deck, either sleeping on a coil of ropes or on a ammo box or something. Actually, the nights are very pretty down about the equator. I enjoyed the night travel. I enjoyed that time on the ocean. In spite of the insecurity about it, that didn't bother me too much. I enjoyed it.
And you got to New Guinea. Was that an eye-opener for a guy from Madeira?
Not really, because in New Guinea they had a replacement depot. We had our tents and cots and everything else, so it was pretty much like any place else. It wasn't too much of a shocker. It was a little different, but again, pleasant enough. While on New Guinea, we had various details. They'd take a group of us out to clear the weeds around the perimeter or go and load ammo or something like that. So we had little details, but mostly it was an easy time, kind of pleasant.
And that would change. You'd have some situations that were a far cry from pleasant. And maybe this is a little hard to go back and remember, but I'm curious, before you ever saw action, before you're ever in a combat zone, do you remember what your expectation was of what your job as a medic was going to be, what you thought it was going to be like?
No, I'm not sure that I particularly worried about it. I did realize that there would be some danger, you know, if we ever got into action. I think my religious upbringing and my Christian faith made it simple for me, and it was, I didn't have any firm expectations one way or the other, no.
You mentioned your faith. Was that something that you were practicing on your own, or did you have some guys around you that helped sharpen you and work on that?
That was pretty much on my own. After, of course, in basic, we had our chaplain and so forth and so on, but from then on, and on the boat, but after that, no. There was no chaplain. I was on my own, yes.
But it sounds like you bring that up, and I get the sense that that gave you some security or assurance or belief that you'd get back to California again someday?
Yes, I honestly thought that I would get back to my home in California at some time or other. I think the concern, and probably the concern would be the same in nearly 100% of the guys. I felt sure that I would get back, but I didn't know how. And I knew that I wanted to go back with two legs and two arms and two hands and my facilities about me. And that was the thing that I was concerned about. Hey, you never know.
And you would be in a situation where you saw a lot of people who would be coming home, if at all, in worse shape than they went over. That's kind of goes along with the territory of being a medic. What was the spot where you first experienced some of that reality of war?
The first real action that I saw was on this convoy. We were on a terrific armada that left from New Guinea and went to the island of Leyte in the Philippines. And when we landed on the beach in the Philippines was the first actual combat that I was involved in. It was different. The actual invasion was not all that like in Europe, where they had the artillery and the rest of it. We didn't have any artillery fired at us. Now, we did have artillery from the cruisers and battleships, and the airplanes off the flat tops were strafing the beaches and dropping bombs on the beaches. They did a pretty thorough job. So when we went ashore, they told us that we would have some resistance on the beach, and we did. And this was the first action that I saw, was when we came ashore. If I remember correctly, and I'm nearly sure of this, there was one group of landing barges hit the beaches, and then I was in the second group. So by the time I got ashore, the small arm fire close to where I was pretty well silenced.
What was that scene like for those of us who weren't there? Can you kind of describe what you were taking in? Because I'm sure there was a lot to take in.
My memory goes back just a little bit to that landing barge as we went over the edge of our APA, Army Personnel Assault, and got into these landing barges, and we had made a couple of dry runs before on New Guinea, so I understood what the ride was going to be like, but they're flat bottomed and flat front, and the most uncomfortable thing that was ever built to go on water. They put us in there like sardines. We were all standing, and every time this boat would get against a wave and stop, we all moved forward with it, and it was a very uncomfortable ride. And I think maybe because the ride was so uncomfortable and we knew it was going to be mean, this took some of the anxiety away and made me want to get on land instead of that miserable little landing barge. And the landing barge and then going on shore, we did wade through water, possibly knee-deep or a little less. And then we got ashore, and my first task, we just barely got on shore, and I think the battalion commander told us to go up and pick up a wounded enemy so they have somebody to interrogate. So we went up to where the riflemen were and asked where the wounded enemy was. They all kind of laughed, and they said, "They're all dead." And there were no wounded enemy for us to pick up. I will say that war is cruel, and the warriors are cruel, and it's a total different life, totally different. Now, landing on the beach, glad to get off the barges, anxious for a spot to keep my head down, stay undercover as much as possible, and that's about it.
And you had gotten plenty of practice on New Guinea, sleeping outside with very little shelter?
Yes, that one night in New Guinea, under the trees with nothing above us or below us. But that still wasn't like actually in the Philippines, because at night, when it became nightfall, we always dug in. We dug in a circle like the old wagon trains, so nobody had his back to the enemy. And we usually dug two-man foxhole, and that way one was on guard and the other was sleeping. I think I mostly slept and let the other guy do the guarding. And sleeping in a mud hole is just different. There's no description I can give you that'd do it justice.
But you had to get used to it, because that was all you're going to have, huh?
Nobody told us that, but that's a fact. You know, one day at a time, and we do it one day at a time, and that's the way it was in the islands. One day at a time.
One day at a time, one battle at a time, one wounded soldier at a time. But what happened when the medic became the patient? And why does Dave consider it his own personal miracle? We're going to explore that with 89-year-old Purple Heart recipient David Wall when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 89-year-old Dave Wall of Reedley, California. Last fall, he got to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. on the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight. His guardian on that flight was his nephew, Sam Wall. And they have pretty parallel stories, both of them medics, one in World War II, one in Vietnam, both Purple Heart recipients. We're going to hear from Sam, too, before we're done. And you can find a photo of this dynamic duo on hometownheroesradio.com or, of course, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Let's get back to Dave's story right now. 19 years old, when you got that first taste of combat, you told us the story of being sent to retrieve enemy wounded, only to find out there weren't any. They'd all been killed. But I'm sure it wasn't long there in the Philippines before you had some of your own 24th Infantry brethren to try to patch up.
When we went up and asked for the wounded enemy, it was almost immediately one of our guys got hit. So we picked him up and took him back to the aid station. So I was picking up wounded from the time I got on the beach.
Was that pretty much a dawn to dusk duty?
Well, the war that I was familiar with wasn't that way. In other words, in our case, we would be fired on, and then the enemy retreated, and we would advance until we found him again. And when we found him is when the shooting went on. Otherwise, there were days on end when I didn't do anything other than march. I say march, walk following the enemy. And when the shooting was on, naturally everybody keeps their head down as much as possible. It was a little more difficult for those of us that are medics because, you know, we had to be up and moving about. So that kind of paints a picture of an aid man or a litter bearer. The troops all around you might very well be pretty close to the ground, but you were standing or walking or near standing position to get to where you had to go.
I know that you're an emotional guy, and I'm just wondering what kind of emotions you dealt with when you're caring for these guys who've been hit, and how you handled the condition that you'd find them in.
During that time, I'm going to say I kind of shut off my emotions, and I didn't have any feeling. I won't say I didn't have any feeling. Naturally, I felt for the guy that was wounded, but I didn't ache for him.
You just wouldn't let yourself go there.
I wouldn't let myself get involved in people problems, no.
I don't want to get into all the guts and gore and just for the sake of doing so, but so we understand what you were dealing with. Can you give us a sense of what kind of injuries you saw, what kind of shape some of these soldiers were in that you had to get back to the aid station?
Yes. Okay. Other than outright dead, I guess I saw every kind of wound that there was. A lot of legs and arms and main body, and it was pretty messy, but like I say, I totally had no feelings, and I have trouble understanding for myself now because it didn't bother me. I wouldn't let it bother me.
And I know there's what about conversations with these guys? Was there anything you could do to try to reassure them or console them?
No, there was very little conversation. I would say the main comment, if the guy was conscious and knew what was going on, was get me out of here. And he really didn't care that the litter ride was bumpy. He wanted to get out of that location where he was possibly still within the enemy fire.
And you shared how it kind of went in waves, and you'd pursue the enemy, and then you'd have another wave of casualties and like that. I guess I'm, again, just trying to imagine being in your shoes, and for some reason I imagine that you would hear someone calling out, medic, medic, quite often. I mean, could you keep up with the number of medic calls that were there?
That's an interesting comment, because I think the most feared sound for a medic was that loud whisper that he didn't want anybody else to hear, but he wanted us to hear, medic, hey, medic, hey, medic, over here. Yes, and the 24th Division, and I mentioned I was a litter bearer, an aid man. Normally there's one aid man with each company, and their experience in New Guinea had been that moving the patient from where he became a casualty back to the aid station was the biggest bottleneck, so they had us guys on detached service. I was on detached service throughout the war. I was with either 1st, 2nd, or 3rd Battalion, depending on which one was going to be in action.
So in other words, reading between those lines, some of those guys get a little day off or away from the front lines, and you're on the front lines regardless of who's out there with you.
That's really more or less the truth. It isn't as if I was doing this every day, because there were days on end when we wasn't involved in any kind of action. But it was pretty constant, and there were a lot of casualties, and I don't want to mention numbers because I don't remember them. I don't know. But I remember some things I learned about myself, about my capabilities and my limitations and so forth and so on. By rights, the aid man was supposed to have gotten to the casualty before we did, but very often it didn't happen. And very often we would intentionally move the patient before any first aid to get him back to the aid station or the battalion surgeon. I'm going to say that I think I remember moving more without doing any first aid than after doing first aid. The main thing to us was to get him out of there.
Before any further damage was done.
Before any more damage, yes.
You shared earlier what some of your concerns were. Did you start to feel a concern or a fear that, hey, I'm out here and there's a lot of stuff flying around, I might get hit one of these days?
Yes, this was a positive thought. And I remember as the war went on, I think all of us recognized that the old-timers tended to get picked off sooner or later. And I honestly worried whether I would make that trip back to California that I so hoped for. And then there was the one time when I was nicked by a bullet. After we landed on the island of Leyte, the first day, we landed in the early morning. By mid-afternoon, we got word that MacArthur was coming ashore, so a couple of us went back to the beach and watched him wait ashore. He came in on an LCT, landing craft tank, which was a little larger than the rest of us troops were on.
Were you guys on LCVPs, or what'd you hit the shore on?
The LCVP was our trip to the beach.
So this is, you know, MacArthur, when he left the Philippines, had famously said, "I shall return." And this is his triumphant return that's been photographed waiting in on Lady there.
That is exactly true. I watched him wade ashore and come up to the newsreel camera, which there was a newsreel camera there. And he made his famous speech, "People of the Philippines, I have returned."
And you were how far away?
Two or three arms distance. I was behind the cameraman, in the area right behind the cameraman. And I saw his lip quiver. So I knew that there were feelings there. There were feelings there. Then after MacArthur came ashore, that was our first day. Then it was on the ninth day when the four of us went to pick up this casualty, and we had picked him up and set him on the litter. And then as I moved around to my corner of the litter, I made the mistake of standing to my full 5 feet, 8.5 inches, and pow, I was knocked flat to my back. And there I found myself with my hands over the sternum. Now, naturally, I thought about that lecture, dead or bleeding to death, and I didn't think I was dead. I didn't feel, as a matter of fact, that I was seriously wounded. So I removed my hands and found a groove across the sternum. Now, recognizing that had I my body been turned one way or the other, I very likely would have been a dead man.
So in your training, you'd gotten this lecture that you weren't even paying attention to until you heard the Bible verse, but you pay attention, and he says, if anything penetrates the sternum, don't bother with it. That guy's a goner. And now you're what, a fraction of an inch away from something penetrating your sternum?
Well, a fraction of an inch, yes. What can I say? It appeared later that this may have ricocheted slightly. It may have changed the direction. I think that I got the shoulder of the bullet versus the tip. And I think had I gotten the tip of the bullet, I'm a dead man.
So in other words, it came straight across your chest, but didn't penetrate far enough.
That's right, exactly. People tell me I was extra lucky at that time. But I say, well, yes, unless you believe like I do that there was divine intervention. And this is simply the long and the short of it. I had my own private miracle, which I carry with me today.
You have that perspective today, and you just said that. You carry with it today. Is that how you felt at that moment? I mean, did it hit you right away that that's what had happened?
As a matter of fact, no. I thought I was just one of the lucky guys, you know. And there were other experiences like that, but none quite as dramatic. And in each instance, I thought, boy, was I lucky I escaped again. I really didn't recognize and realize what was going on. No. I didn't think of it at the time as being divine intervention. I thought of it as being a lucky hombre.
What changed your mind? Because you look pretty convinced of it now.
Well, I think the years that have gone by did it to me. Now, obviously, I'm a lot older now than I was then. And the years and realizing what happened. And it has been called back to my attention.
How serious were you hurt? Did it take you out of action for a while?
As a matter of fact, no. When I saw that it wasn't serious, I jumped to my feet and grabbed the litter, and we made tracks down to the battalion aid station. And I did do this. When the ambulance came to pick up this party, I went with the ambulance back to my company. And for the next week or so, all I did was unload ambulance or goof around or didn't do much of anything during that time. And then our other people came back when the battalion was relieved, and then we were there for another week or so until we went out on the next mission. So I really wasn't, I was out of action for maybe a couple of weeks.
You had a flesh wound that had to heal on your chest?
Yes, it was kind of laughable. It wasn't that serious, you know. So there's a little flesh wound, a little bleeding. So what?
Well, it was enough for them to award you the Purple Heart, so it wasn't insignificant. But it sounds like you weren't looking for an excuse to get out of action, that you wanted to continue doing what you were doing. Why was that?
Well, I wouldn't say I wanted to, but when they said, let's go, we went. And that is the way with the military. When they say frog, you jump. And it was that simple. When they woke me, I was in a foxhole. And he said, get your stuff together because you're going out. He said, first go down to the mess hall and have your breakfast. So we did. The eight of us that were on detached service had breakfast before we got on the ship and went on the next mission.
And where'd you go from there?
The next mission took us around the other side of the island. And then we went back up through the boonies. There were no roads, no airports, no rivers to go on. And the riflemen hadn't had breakfast, but we were assured that we would be followed by a group of Filipino carriers that would bring us our rations. And this was on a Friday, as I recall. We marched and marched until noontime, always looking back, still no carriers. We marched until evening, still looked back and still no carriers. And then Saturday, we marched and marched till noon and no carriers, until evening and no carriers. Sunday morning, still no food, and we walked till noon, and by then the troops were all pretty tired, and we were not in shape to go on, really. And I guess our commanding officer got somebody on the hose, and within, I'd say, 45 minutes, a couple of C-47s with our biscuit bombers came by and dropped the rations to us, and then we had field rations from then on. Then we went on, took this position up on the hills. There were four hills where we took our positions. We were overlooking what was known as the Ormoc Corridor, and the Ormoc Corridor was the last place the enemy could still get to the ocean and get resupplied or get off the island. So we were told to hold our position there at all cost. And we were up there for 31 days. And during that time, we brought the casualties to the battalion aid station, which was us. And then we got Filipino carriers each day bringing in rations and ammo and carrying the wounded back out. So we were there for 31 days. And incidentally, the battalion got a presidential citation for that particular mission.
Well, and you kind of nonchalantly threw out that your orders were to hold at all costs, but that is a pretty tall order. And there were a lot of places where people who got that order paid a really heavy cost. And I imagine there were some significant casualties there. Is there something else that enters your mind, or a next level of motivation, do you think, occurs when you get that order, hold at all costs? Because that's not a maybe. That's a pretty absolute.
I think I thought of it much like any other orders that I got. So we hold our position, you know. And we did, and it was uncomfortable, but, you know, what can I say?
And you mentioned earlier how you didn't let some of the emotions get to you. But do you look back at it now and see what you did and say, how in the world did I keep going and going and going and going?
That is a thought, and like I say, at the time, my emotions were totally shut off. Yes, I wonder how I did it. I wonder how I did it and why I did it, Sam. Is that right? Yeah.
And even if you weren't allowing yourself to get too close to some of these guys, I imagine you developed an impression of the kind of people these were, the guys that were dying there, the guys that you were treating that you knew were going to go home and not the same kind of shape they came in. What do you think we need to understand about the kind of people that were over there fighting for freedom?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer it. We were people. We were no different than anybody else. Young people, to be sure, most of us.
When this fighting's going on, when you're wounded and all this is happening, to put it in context, you're, what, 19 years old?
Yes, I was 19, turned 20 at that time, and I was home and got my discharge the day before my 21st birthday. So I was in at 18 and out at 20 at 21. Now I see 21-year-old kids and 18-year-old kids, and I think, these are kids. But to me, at the time, I thought I was as capable as anybody else, and probably I was for what I had to do.
Well, you got the job done, and we're not done just yet. More from Dave when we come back, and we'll hear as well from a Vietnam veteran with a Silver Star and two Purple Hearts. It's Dave's nephew, Sam Wall. The rest of Hometown Heroes comes your way right after this.
I'm really trying to redefine the hearing aid in general. Today's modern hearing aid is vastly different from your father's or grandfather's hearing aid.
Nathan Love, owner of Sound Advice, with an eye-opener for our ears.
We've got hearing aids now that are directly linked to iPhones. You can stream phone calls directly from your iPhone to your hearing devices without any intermediate piece at all. If you're on a jog and you want to listen to music, you stream music directly from your phone to your hearing device.
Sound Advice, with new innovative products and the best possible care by a licensed hearing aid professional.
Well, I'll be happy to give somebody a consultation. There's no cost to that. I'll give you all the different price points and then shop around, because you have to find not only a device that suits you, but a provider that suits you as well.
Begin your quest for better hearing. Call Sound Advice at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Dave Wall has shared some of his experiences as a medic with the 1st Battalion, 34th Regiment, 24th Infantry Division in World War II. He told us the story of his own personal miracle, and his Purple Heart is a constant reminder of that. He also remembered being just a few feet away when General Douglas MacArthur made his triumphant return to the Philippines. That was on Leyte, but Dave, eventually you would leave that island and see some more of the Philippines, right?
When the island of Leyte was pretty well secure, they sent the 1st Battalion of the 34th Regiment up north to the island of Luzon, which is the big island. We invaded north of the Bataan Peninsula and came down to the Bataan Peninsula and crossed the upper Bataan Peninsula near Manila. Now, at this point, the one thing that's memorable to me and that I'll always remember it for, when we were on this road towards Manila, we were told that that was the same road that had been the Bataan Death March a few years before. So to me, that was a historic event and one that I'll always remember, not because of the enemy action. However, the one different thing about this was the one time where I saw a lot of artillery fire. We saw some artillery fire during the war up till now, but here was our artillery shooting over us and their artillery shooting back. So I was right in the middle watching those shells pass back and forth, and that was kind of interesting.
How much interaction did you have with the Filipino people, and what impression did they leave on you?
The Philippines, their economy had been totally shut down, and they were very anxious to see us. The reaction or interaction with them, I didn't personally have a lot. I remember once in a while when we were at a pause, when we were tired of field rations, we'd find a Filipino farmer and buy a dozen eggs and boil them, and we'd have boiled eggs. Also, what laundry I had done was done by the Filipino ladies down at the river, and they had them on stone, and that's where they cleaned our clothes. But no, I didn't have a lot to do with Filipinos. They were lovely people. I still, when I see a Filipino a block away, I can tell he's a Filipino. I still recognize him when I meet him in the store. Hey, you're from the Philippines, right? Sure. Well, I was over there during the war, and that gives us something to talk about.
Where were you when you heard the war was over?
After Luzon, we went to Mindoro for rest and relaxation. We got to rest a few days, and then they called us out on a mission there on Mindoro. And then from Mindoro, we went to the island of Mindanao, and we had made our landing in the beach hid and all the rest of it. And we were going towards, now the name doesn't mean much, except the one high mountain in the Philippines is Mount Apo, Apo, I think it is. And we were heading towards Mount Apo into the high country. The enemy was always retreating to the high country so that he had a high spot. So that's where we were going. Now, as the war was winding down and it was obvious to us that it was not as active as it had been, I ended up with yellow jaundice. What's the name for it?
Hepatitis.
And I was back in the hospital when I heard that the war, that we dropped the atomic bombs. But I was theoretically on Mindanao, but I was not. I was back on Leyte in the, at that time, a convalescent hospital. And I heard about atomic bomb, and I didn't, none of us knew anything about atomic energy. I was able to tell the guys, well, I remember my older brother in college used to talk about splitting the atom. And I asked him, what in the world would the option of splitting something so small you can't see it? what is all this atom monkey business? And then, of course, the atom bomb woke us all up to the fact that we were in a new age. And after the atomic bomb, the first one was dropped, an officer that was a college man and he knew what was going on gave us a little lecture about atomic bombs and what had happened. And he did tell us that one of the things they were afraid of was that when the bomb went off, it would never stop. It would continue. And, of course, it was controlled. But it's a horrible thing, the atomic bomb. But it ended the war for me. And we were obviously getting ready for the invasion of Japan.
So the bomb might have saved your life.
That is a very possible possibility and probably a likelihood, and a lot of others. The invasion of Japan would have been a horrible thing.
No question. What was it like to come home to see your family again? What do you remember about that?
I first of all might say sailing into the San Francisco Golden Gate was a beautiful thing. The buses took us up to Camp Beale, where I was eventually discharged. I called home and got my brother and my mother and my sister. They came with him up there to Camp Beale and picked me up. So I got my deluxe ride back to Madera. Naturally a big relief, but for me at that time I wanted to put the war behind me, and I refused to talk about it at that time.
How long did that last?
About 45 years. Actually, until the honor flight, I never talked much about it, and I think I pretty much put it out of my mind until the time of the honor flight, and it gave us an opportunity to see that, hey, we did what was expected of us by our fellow citizens and our government. And no regrets, no sadness, neither any hurrah, look what I did. Someplace in between those extremes.
What was the honor flight experience like for you? What was the highlight of it?
Well, the highlight for me was the fact that Sam and I had planned this trip for about 5 years ahead at that time. And we had planned to go to D.C., specifically the Vietnam Memorial, which is a very touching experience. Sam at the time told me, he says, I want you to go with me because you'll understand. And I knew that Sam was a Purple Heart veteran, and I was a Purple Heart veteran. So we had that in common. We put off this trip and put off this trip and put off this trip until finally the honor flight thing came along. And I called Sam one evening and he said, you know, Chris and I have been talking about you. Are you interested in that honor flight thing? I said, by all means. So he said, let's go. And I said, you'll be my companion? He said, sure. So ultimately, Sam and I went together. And on the honor flight between Fresno and D.C., I told Sam I was an emotional person and I would surely cry. And he said he would too. So that was understood. And as we approached the Vietnam Wall, he told me, he said, I never told you this, but I was not only a Purple Heart veteran, I was twice awarded the Purple Heart, and I was awarded the Silver Star. Now I said, Sam, what did you do to get that? You know, the Silver Star is not like a coin to go buy an ice cream cone. So we saw the Vietnam Wall. We had our cry, and I think that probably a third of the guys my age that were the veterans joined us by wiping their tears away and shedding a few tears. So that was very meaningful to me to get to know Sam a little better. And then the World War II Memorial was very meaningful. The whole thing was very well done, just a delightful experience.
When you talk about the Vietnam Wall and how many of the veterans teared up, as you mentioned, I don't know if everyone listening expects that, because they would just assume that what was the most powerful thing for you was that World War II Memorial. It's the newest thing there and the reason you're going. What was so powerful about seeing all those names on the wall?
I think the fact that the Vietnam Wall is a beautiful thing. It's a black granite, polished. It's a beautiful thing. And it's from about 2.5 feet high to probably 6 feet high or 6.5 feet high. The fact that there were 58,000 names of young guys that were like me when I was involved. And I think that made it a very powerful thing to me. And I believe to the other veterans as well.
You know, and I was curious. And when you got to the World War II Memorial, there aren't names on the wall, but there are 4,000 gold stars representing over 405,000 Americans killed in World War II. really staggering number. Is part of it the fact that when you guys finished World War II, your hope was that that really was the war to end all wars and that you wouldn't have something claiming the lives of 58,000 Americans like Vietnam did?
The World War II memorial was not an emotional thing for me. Seeing all the stars that represented the deaths, and there were many of them, but it was just a thing. The Vietnam Memorial was more than a thing. It was a personal thing because there were names chiseled in stone, and it just was a very meaningful thing to me, more meaningful than anything else, I think, of the memorial.
And to be able to share that with someone else who went through similar things had to make it even more special for you.
Yes, by all means. And I've talked to Sam about this. I think that, you know, the expression, it takes one to know one. And I think that nobody totally appreciates, in spite of what I may say or what other veterans may say, that totally understands and totally has the feel that some of us had because of what happened.
What would you say was your biggest takeaway from the Honor Flight experience, the biggest thing that is still with you right now?
Okay, I think to me, the Vietnam Memorial was the most meaningful to it, always will be. I think the other fact that we saw the Korean Memorial, we saw the Air Force, the Navy, and all these various memorials, but it all together made a unit. But the one outstanding thing to me will always be the Vietnam Memorial.
Did you have some family waiting for you when you got back?
Oh, yes. That was a very delightful thing. I had never expected to see a time when I and the others would be greeted like that, with the band playing and the, cheerleaders doing their thing and all this other stuff. And it was a very exciting thing to me to see the way we were sent off and the way we were gathered when we got back. It was a delightful thing.
Just a couple more things, and I want to ask Sam a couple questions, but is there anything else that you want to say about him? Because I get the sense that you're pretty proud of your nephew over there.
Very proud of my nephew. You know, I had one occasion when the officer in charge of this group of men, we were pinned down by a machine gun that was hidden in the underbrush, and he asked me personally if I wanted a Silver Star. He said, all you have to do is stand up and empty your rifle towards that machine gun where we think it is, and then my guys will see the machine gun and they can take him out. Well, he said, at least a Bronze Star, if not a Silver Star. Well, you know, from that one experience and the various other experiences I had during the war, I know that those medals are not cheap. They come by at a terrible cost to somebody. And naturally, I'm proud of Sam for what he did in Vietnam. He would probably say he's proud of me for what I did, and I didn't do anything other than what I was told to do. So, yes, I'm very proud of Sam.
Well, I'm going to bug him in a second, but I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. And is there anything else that you think we need to understand about your experience? Is there something that you just look back and you're really thankful for or proud of?
Well, when you said thank you for your service, it brought another thing to my memory. On this honor flight, we got a hat that says Veteran of World War II. Wearing that cap has attracted people that I met on the street that I didn't know in Los Angeles area. They'd stop me on the street and say, thank you for serving our country. And I thought that was pretty terrific. I really did.
Well, I hope there's a whole lot more of that to come. Thanks again, Dave. And let's talk now for a few minutes with Sam Wall, Dave's nephew. Sam, did you grow up knowing what your uncle did in World War II?
I didn't know the details, but I did know that he was a combat medic in World War II.
Did that have anything to do with your outlook when you ended up heading off to war?
Not really. He didn't speak a whole lot about it. We didn't discuss that sort of thing. I went out with an outlook because I was drafted. I'd wanted to go to alternate service as a conscientious objector, but I was drafted because there was a bunch of group in Madera that were putting up a ruckus, and so therefore the draft board says, well, you're going to go. I didn't have a chance to fight it. So I went as a conscientious objector and ended up in Vietnam as a medic.
So you've learned a lot about your uncle's service just In the last few months here, the last year, huh?
In the last, since October, the Honor Flight, I've learned a lot more. In fact, the interview we had today with my uncle, I learned the unit he was with. I'd never known that before now.
And he told us a story of how you guys ended up on the Honor Flight. What was that experience like? And can you help us understand the bond that the two of you have because of your similar experiences?
It just brought us so close together because, well, we basically knew what we were each thinking.
Tell us what that Honor Flight was like for you. What were some of the things that you saw or experienced or came to understand because of that experience?
Well, I had gone to the Vietnam Memorial in 84, right after it was opened, before the nurse was even up. The three soldiers were there, but not the nurse. And I made those who were with me leave me alone so I could walk it alone. And I did. Very difficult time. But to have a group of comrades go through that a second time and be able to find names on there of the day that I saw my comrades die and I earned that Silver Star was extremely meaningful. It maybe gave some closure or maybe gave some purpose to what happened to my life.
Maybe you can give us a brief sketch of that incident that earned you the Silver Star. And I know it's not easy to talk about, and you just told us that it resulted in some of those names being on that wall. But can you just give us a sense of what that was and how difficult it was for you?
We were ambushed. We were driving down the road getting resupplies from our combat base to our supply depot. The powers that be thought it would be good if we kind of took the same route in the same time so that we could initiate combat. And well, it was an ambush, and they waited for the first armored personnel carrier to get through, and then they hit the second one, which I was riding on, with a rocket-propelled grenade. As a result of the combat, there were any number of men that were in the kill zone that were wounded and needed to be pulled to safety, and without thinking, I just pulled four of them to safety, went back for the fifth guy, and was unable to get him back, so I put tourniquets on all four of his limbs, hoping that he would survive until we could get help to pull him out again. That's basically the day, the event, the 15 minutes of horror that I went through.
And were you wounded in that attack as well?
Well, I wasn't pierced with a bullet or anything like that, but because the rocket-propelled grenade hit the same side of the vehicle I was on, I was thrown off the vehicle, so my back re-injured my back from a previous time I had a Purple Heart. And I continued to help the wounded until we got everybody medevaced out, and then I asked permission to go back and see if I was okay. And so they medevaced me back out, and out of my platoon, I was the only one that made it back the third time from both attacks. And fortunately, in Vietnam at the time, the second time you were wounded, they pulled you back from the front. So after a short period of time, they pulled me back from the front then.
So you mentioned you're the only one from your platoon to make it back the third time, and I'm guessing some of the names on that wall were guys from that platoon.
Correct. There were 10 guys that were in that platoon that were killed and on that wall. And I'll just drop a name here. Thomas Vey, the sports director at Fresno State, helped me find those names on that honor flight in October.
As you were listening to Dave tell his story and all the questions I asked him about his mindset or how you deal with that, was your experience pretty similar to that? I mean, did you kind of have to desensitize yourself or numb yourself to some of those issues?
Well, yeah, but, you know, the group of guys we were with for that year, we became very, very close, not necessarily emotionally, but we would die for each other. We looked out for each other. We were comrades. We were very tight, yet we didn't let the emotions get to us. There was that bond, but there was also a distance that when they did die after the memorial service and we got on, we did what we had to do.
Was this experience going with your uncle to those memorials, was this a cathartic thing for you too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We were able to, I was able to express with him and share with him some of the experiences that I had. I haven't been able to share with anybody else. Some of the stories that we had, I talked at the wall with, and the guy from EECU, who was the cameraman along with us, got one of my stories about the day we ate deer meat in Vietnam. I think that what they're doing for Honor Flight, the group that put that together, is It's outstanding. It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
Is it just knowing that somebody cares, that this actually matters to somebody and what you did was not for naught?
I think there is some of that, but I think as well, it goes to the fact that we see how people think of us in at the memorials. As we came into to Baltimore Washington International, and to see how we were greeted there, and every one of those veterans from World War II got the kiss on the cheek, and some of those guys didn't wash that off until after they got back to Fresno. But to see how people treated us, and that, you know, we aren't, especially from the Vietnam era, we weren't the villains that some of the people wanted to make us out to be, that we were people that were normal, that's a good thing.
Amen. Thanks, Sam. Dave Wall and Sam Wall, pretty unique connection that uncle and nephew have with each other. They'll both receive CD copies of this program, courtesy of one of our sponsors, EECU. And EECU has also been a huge supporter of Central Valley Honor Flight. If you at home want more information on the Honor Flight program and the hub in your area, just check out the interactive map on honorflight.org. There is a little more from my chat with Dave and Sam that I couldn't squeeze into our radio time this week, but you can access the entire interview online at hometownheroesradio.com. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.
Okay, a little background for those who are not familiar with the history. Corregidor is the island that's in the middle of the Manila Bay, and this is where MacArthur had holed up with his troops when they were losing. MacArthur was ordered away by Roosevelt, and they got him out of there on a submarine and took him to Australia, from where he directed the rest of the war. Now, Corregidor was a rock in the middle of the harbor, very similar to Alcatraz in San Francisco. We were on the same road that was known as the Bataan Death March. When MacArthur left, he left General Wainwright in charge, and General Wainwright was forced to surrender the troops and those that were with him due to lack of food and water. Those two essentials made it necessary for him to surrender. And from there, he went with his troops after surrendering on a march that was about 70 miles. And for him
with troops surrendering marched up 70 miles.
Was it chosen to correct on a honor
and from
on
the
on
honor with on group with on rendering
on
rendering
on
seven
on kind was it kind
sir for him
kind chose kind correct kind kind kind
and
I kind
the
kind because I kind
with
kind
groups
and
rendering
and
marched up
and
70
and was it and chose and
to
and correct and
and from
the
with
the
fruit with
the fur rendering
the fur rendering
the fur
seven
the fur the fur was it the fur
sir for him
the fur chose and he was like and he was like and he was like and he was like I when he was like and he was like cause I he was like
with
and he was like
groups
and he was like
rendering
and he was like
marched
and he was like
70
was it chose
to
correct
and from the
with
group
with
rendering
with
rendering
with
seven
with truth with treasury with truth
sir for him
with truth chose with truth correct with truth with truth
and from the
because I
with groups rendering marched up 70
was it chose to correct
and from
the
with group with rendering
they did was it they did
sir for him
they did chose they did correct they did
and
I they did
the
they did because
with rendering
rendering
7 marched up
was it
sir for him
chose correct I
the with group with rendering rendering 7
was it chose
sir for him
correct.
And from
the
group with group with rendering rendering of 70
was it chose correct they did
and from
they did they did they did
with
they did
group with
they did
rendering
they did
rendering
they did
70
they did was it to
sir for him
to chose to correct to
and
to cuz I
with groups rendering marched up 70
was it chosen
to
correct
and from
the
with groups rendering marched up 70 with groups surrendering
Sir, for him, we chose. Tom, we back.